Good morning and welcome to the June 3rd, 2024 meeting of the Chelan County Public Library District Commission. I'd like to thank everybody for participating this morning. To remind you to silence your phones and electronic devices. Today's meeting is a steady business session with steady sessions starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business sessions. There might be a chance that we're coming fast. We'll get there. We welcome the public's input of our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. Members of the public are encouraged to provide comments and ask the specific questions after each item presented. If you wish to provide additional comments or ask questions related to information that's not on the agenda, we will have some information at the end of this morning's meeting and as well this afternoon for time for people to comment. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand. Let us know that you'd like to comment and come up to the microphone that's up here in the front. And when we recognize you, please state your name and address for the record. Talk closely to the into the microphone and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have currently 3 commissioners present. We may have 2 more come late. We have John Stoll, acting general manager. General counsel Charles Von Reese will be acting general counsel, and Rebecca Newman, clerk of the board. Would you please join Allison Bergstrom this morning in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and our safety meeting.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic because my safety topic for the safety minute is on summer safety. I was going to talk about heat and sun and water safety, but those items are pretty well understood by all. So I thought I'd touch on a couple other topics. Slide, please. So day hiking is pretty popular in our area. We're blessed with a lot of beautiful sites to hike in. So I thought I would share a few of the items for enjoy our summer without having any tragedy. So firstly, you should probably not go alone, but if you do, make sure you tell someone where you're going and when you're going to be back. And for hiking boots, just obviously comfortable footwear, something maybe with some ankle support, and I find that boot socks is kind of my go-to. And being alert for wildlife and snakes, and just kind of keeping your eyes about you, having a plan if you're going to if you were to approach a bear, if a bear is near you, what would you do? If you see a snake, what are your options? I think hiking poles would probably be a good option too. I have a colleague of mine shared how she helped ward off a snake with safety with a hiking pole, so that's something that I'd add. And also just places are out in the forest. So if you're going to be going where there's tall grasses or anything like that, I think small camps is a good option in the first checking yourself and any animals, your dog or what have you, when you return home. I would say know where you are along your journey. If you are going on a day hike, if you don't want to be, you kind of want to know where you are and how many miles you're planning to go so that you can plan appropriately if you need to turn around and go back or continue doing the loop, but just kind of making sure you know where you are and can make it back before your end zone. For those of you who might be maybe traveling with less experienced hikers, or if someone's injured or just not well or had words or themselves, you might have some folks that are upset or in pain or what have you, and it's really important to keep positive attitude. Things may not go according to plan either. You might hit some weather. So just try to keep a positive attitude so you can make sure that you can meet yourself and your group out and have a good time and a safe time. For your backpack, you want to travel lightly, of course, but there are some things that I won't put into you, but those are some great go-tos to bring with you. And for a cell phone, of course, you may always you may signal, but one thing I want to highlight is you can actually turn on your locator, especially if you're going by yourself or if you'd like someone to be able to find you. If you go in your, like if you have an iPhone, go into settings, and then on your name, you can tap Find My, and then you turn on Share My Location. And you can select specific individuals, and I think that's a great best practice, just in case you were to get into trouble.
Yes, I said.
I presume so. Someone else has information about that? Well, maybe you'd be in the area. I guess it only works if you're not that far. Probably not a bad thing to do, right? Especially if you're like, and then slide, please. So the other item I want to talk about, which is travel, if you're taking a road trip, for example, you know, just like hiking, providing your itinerary as a family or friends, it's not a bad idea. And if you're going on a road trip or a long trip to the airport, you want to just make sure you've given your car a checkup. So I think that's a great best practice, especially if you're going to more remote areas like national parks, just having an emergency kit in your car as well, or you having a spare tire. Hopefully you know how to use those things. It wouldn't really do me much good to have a spare tire if I don't know how to put one on. So just getting a little training and being comfortable with those things. And I think also having, I love maps. I still love paper maps. Your Google Maps can sometimes be wrong. You might not have a signal. And so it's a good idea to have a map with you as well in case you need to reroute. For emergency alerts, you can also, again, this also implies it would be an area where we have service, but you can turn on the emergency alert setting on your phone, and you can download the Red Cross emergency app. There's a picture of that there, and that's great. It gives you weather updates, safety tips, and shelter locations, especially if you'll be in a tornado or and then for international travel, just it's really important to check travel advisories. Volatile right now, and just depending on where you're going, do check those. Be aware of your surroundings. Carry paper versions of your backup documents and passport and things like that. You can also sign up for the State Department's Traveler Agility, the SMART, and that would be a good way to have consular and embassy locations as well. And let's see. Yeah, and just as another note, I mean, I think we all know this, but when we go to a foreign country, just understanding some local customs and what things may be offensive, you know, for example, wearing shoes in certain places, having to wear a headscarf, things like that in certain areas, you want to make sure that you are aware of some local customs and that you don't do anything that could, you know, bring attention to yourself. And especially in like a crowded area, like a bazaar, for example, kind of have an exit strategy, it's a crowded place, situational awareness. Being your own advocate for safety. But having said that, we kind of don't really want to think about the dangers. We just want to think about having fun. So if we plan well, we should have a safe time, a good time, and then and not have to do anything bad. And so we need to be prepared. So next slide. Done. So unless you have any questions, hopefully you will all have a safe and happy summer with lots of new family memories that you can pull.
Comments, questions? Thanks, Allison. Commissioners, management is recommending the resolutions 13 and 15 to the consent agenda, along with 10 that's already there. Additionally, for the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon any request of a commission member. Do I hear any such requests or additions to the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda stands. John, let's go ahead and move into item number 3, liability insurance
Yes, I'd like to call Ron Gibbs. Ron's been working hard as this time of year, as he does every year, to get insurance for us. This year is proving to be another challenging year. And actually, this is a good presentation that'll actually help lead into when we talk about fire safety program as well.
Topic at hand today is captive insurance.
Can you pull your microphone a little closer? Yeah, tip it up there. There you go. Thank you.
Captive insurance. We wanted to update the board with results of the evaluation process so far. And to make sure the board is comfortable with captive insurance as we continue the evaluation process. We've been informed by one of our insurance carriers that we will be reducing our wildfire liability insurance on this by $35 million. And our broker advises that we cannot cover this. Big reason why we're exploring. Currently, the estimate is that we'll have a $20 million gap in margin. So we've been considering captive insurance as a crucial insurance in order to fill that gap. And I'll say up front that normally we like to come to these presentations full evaluation. But unfortunately, the market conditions change rapidly so quickly. But we've been left with a pretty tight timeline. We've made a lot of progress. On the next slide, I'll provide an overview. If first it makes sense to cover how we are in the situation or in the current insurance market conditions. And so I think most are aware that the utility industry is encountering a lot of wildfires of last year. And the insurance companies have responded accordingly, especially in the Western US, and their utilities are seeing a substantial increase in premiums. We're also seeing a pullback in price. So a lot of people are also seeing a So a lot of these changes have happened since the first of this year, actually. So trying to rapidly adjust to these conditions. But the insurance carriers do, the insurance companies do type the right number of wildfire events that's caused in the current conditions. I think we've all become accustomed to hearing about California wildfires. But over the last, 2020, especially, we've had quite a few losses that have happened outside of California. So this is one of the losses that occurred outside of California since 2020. So as you can see here, spread throughout the West, Hawaii, Oregon, here in Washington, wasn't quite as big as the others, so pretty meaningful for those of us in Eastern Washington. And I think you'll all recall that each year I go meet with insurance underwriters to try and make the case to get the lowest premiums and conditions for our insurance policies. And I can say that in meeting after meeting, underwriters talked about two developments in last year, 2023, that really caused them concerns and changed really the perspective of insurance with respect to utilities in the Western US. The first was the Lahaina fire, which obviously was a very large fire, but it occurred in a location that was not high. I think the theme you'll see with all of these fires, if you look into them further, is that they're not all in high fire risk locations. They're not in high fire risk locations. All these events occurred. If you look at the Colorado, expecting a major fire this in Colorado, especially. So the insurance companies are concerned that there's a broader exposure to wildfire risk, not just the high risk locations, but areas that they consider low risk. Unfortunately, Shaolin County has a fair amount of territory that is considered. So imagine they're concerned about low fire areas. More so certainly. So the second development was the 2023 Curry verdict for the Labor Day fires in Oregon. And the verdict awarded an average $6 million per under the loss curve. So that's a really large award level for compared to historical levels. The vast majority of those damages would compensate for the emotional distress that homeowners would. They've been rolling down a few places here, I should add, even the fire, the fire. And so the way the courts have been handling it is they've been rolling out these awards in waves, they're following the same formula, the numbers have jumped around a little bit, certain things, home value. Very high. So imagine, well, I'll add to that. The verdict is subject to appeal, but the impact to the individual and utility world have been increased. Obviously, they're worried that this could be any more difficult that was in the entire awards. I'll say too that during awards in general, and you know, during awards in general, increasing as well. I think we've all seen our liability policy prices go up. That's a big part of it. Same with homeowners in the government, with liability provision. And so it's impacting utility insurance as well. You know, and our staff is also quite frank. If we were to have a major fire with a horse inside, you know, we'd be concerned that we may not have enough insurance. We're going to be able to afford the insurance we need to hold on. And when I talk to the risk managers at other utilities, they're all having everybody is really good monitoring the field process, but also other litigation involvement. Really, the state with certainty if it is going to be trying to prepare. And then the other piece of it, of course, is as the exposure is increasing, insurance is going to be more than what coverage, right? So it's difficult to fix the beginning of this facility. I will say also that our insurance brokers find that some carriers are not even providing quotes for coverage unless there's a substantial wildfire mitigation program in place and a phone type program in place. So there's some carriers that unless you have a deer, they won't take a right here. And I'll say as well that fortunately we've made a lot of progress in our own program. We're in a better position than a lot of utilities in the West. You know, a broker advises that other clients work on the wildfire mitigation side and don't have that some type of program in place are seeing even greater increases. But all that said, the current estimate is that we will be paying 2 to 3 times what we paid last year based on current estimates. I just wanted to kind of set the landscape there. So getting back to captive insurance, our brokers recommend that we consider this option to address this gap in liability coverage. The definition of captive insurance is form of self-insurance or by an insurance company that's owned and controlled by its insurers. And so the purpose, if we were to use this strategy, that would be to optimize our overall strategy for maintaining insurance coverage while our liability risk. So if we were to choose a captive option, we would potentially be operating like if we had our own insurance. And the interesting thing about operating your own insurance company is that that gives you access all different types of insurance called reinsurance. And reinsurance is simply insurance that's sold exclusively to other insurance. So we don't have access to that now. We have our own captive insurance company, and we could get quotes and reinsurance that we call our liability. Reinsurance is actually very common. Most, a lot of insurance that you might be buying, you don't realize the insurance company, maybe they offer 20 million in coverage or a company that you're involved with. But if there was a company that had 20 million in coverage, they might buy 10 million as reinsurance to cover loss. So it's very common insurance to sell there. The other advantage the captive insurance has is allow the broker to deploy some strategies and negotiations with our insurance. And I'm trying to get too technical, but essentially insurance companies at the upper layers have under normal circumstances can seek the price of the lower layers. We can introduce a captive into one of those layers, and I'll show you. Structure that we think could occur for the or July 1st. So if we were to introduce a captive at this layer of insurance, for example, 75 to 95 million dollar limit, these upper layers of insurance can't see the pricing down below. And the advantage there is that if the lower, the companies lower layers start increasing the pricing, typically what happens is the higher insurance layers adjust with a ripple effect all the way through the program. I mean, our broker did say that one of his clients, say 47% by deployment strategy on one of his companies, he was able to work with the underwriter to find out what the price would have been if it didn't have the captive. So they were at 7%. Just an example, I'm not going to say that that's going to be for typical, but certainly over time, price and savings. Well, I will add too that this is our current estimate. Negotiations are going on every day. And so this was the estimate when we first started the negotiation process. This is the $20 million that we don't think government traditional insurance that might change its location within the tower. So still have that $20 million been available to us. All that, the captive insurance is not a new type of insurance. It's been around for decades. The district hasn't created a captive prior to this point in time, just simply because we haven't needed to. We've been able to resolve our insurance. And to be quite frank, they are typically more expensive, at least historically, than traditional insurance, just because of the administration costs. In 2021, the Washington State Insurance Commissioner publicly stated the captive insurance is a prudent disadvantage. And then Washington State has RTWs in place specific to manage the regulatory situation for captive insurance. Moving on to slide 5. So this broker is recommending that this partner, what they call GIS, and they have already set up a captive that we could become a member of. So It's a form of captive insurance, but you wouldn't have to go through all the regulatory steps to create that standalone captive. I'll provide a little bit more information in a moment about the standalone insurance, because that remains an option for it. But first, I'll talk a little bit about the EIS itself. EIS, formed in 1992. Owned by a company that we have a long partnership with, the insurance mutual. So an insurance company will work with owners of the insurance company. By the way, ironically, somewhat ironically, this is the company that's also reducing our liability limits by $35 million, okay? You know, EIM was formed by the utility industry for the utility industry. That's all they insure. And so if they're pulling back coverage, when their whole purpose is to service, I think the indication of the concerns that are out there about wildfire losses. Currently, there's so they created EIS, there are currently 22 EIS members. To join my membership, it's $5,000 roughly. There's a little fine tuning like that, but the estimate. You can see some of the current members, pretty notable members as part of that. The advantage, as I mentioned, well, for one, EIS, I should clarify, the EIS also established a separate entity called ERS. We're going to use those terms a little bit interchangeably because it's all managed by the same company. All of the documentation is all the same, but they set up a separate entity because Washington has pretty stringent financial planning. So here, ERS, that's now. So EIS will rent the management EIS register chart. Washington perform all of the insurance, reinsurance policies, providing the investment tax services. When the district would form an advisory committee that would direct on all insurance purchases. Direct EIS to do that. With consideration, think about. They represent, there's no pay for other members' liability. That would verify that. It's, they provide flexibility, especially in liability. Nice file, a little bit. You know, we are dealing with regulatory. Well, Washington State is very particular language in RCWs, on the capital insurance. Especially this self-captive type insurance. So EIS is impossible. Washington State, I think the insurance commission, we've been having conversations as well. With the goal of making sure that this self-captive can meet the requirements of the RCWs. So at this point in time, the state's having internal discussions, waiting for information for you to see. So this, at this point, kind of in the holding pattern. If, as I mentioned before, for some reason, self-captive, the EIS self-captive is unable to clear all the regulatory rules, it can be. Our own standalone captive insurance company. It's much more straightforward. The state's actually already told us this. Unfortunately, the process to set up a standalone company takes a little longer. Probably wouldn't have something in place by the July 1st. Current estimate is possibly by August 30. So, and then the other piece, as I mentioned earlier, is that it can be a little bit more costly to operate. So, really, it's 150,000 acres, 5,000 acres that we were in the editorial earlier. But we knew that captive insurance is part of a longer term strategy, not just for this year, but as the market conditions change, sure, will be a tool that we could use to help. Last slide, I mentioned that captive provides additional flexibility. I'm not going to go through all of this, but I just wanted to highlight a couple of things. Within the captive risk layer, you have the option of using how much reinsurance you apply. So you might cover the full 20 million gap of 100% reinsurance at 50%, like 30 or 70%. And you can make those decisions based on pricing received, terms and conditions. This gives you a flexibility within that layer to address that risk in the best way as it fit. So that's what all of these changing numbers are. You know, if you had a 50% reinsurance covered within the captive, for example, you'd still have 10 million that was covered by self-insurance and 10 million covered by it. Just wanted to point out flexibility that this provides. Of course, if we were to forego captive insurance, we would cover any gaps in our wildfire insurance by increasing our liquidity reserves. That's the primary method that we would look at. And then if we were to have a loss, we would consider some additional considerations. With captive claims reserves, essentially, you pay what's called a premium into the captive reserves. It's established by an actuary that works for EIS and meets this particular captive that's domiciled in South Carolina. Washington State doesn't offer the opportunity to domicile a captive insurance in Washington State. And so there's a minimum reserve that you have established. If you were to capitalized and talk to Treasury, they don't have any concern. That would impact our district. Of course, our, well, one major thing we talked about is like by reinsurance. Reinsurance, then the compensation, then capitalize the whole thing, covers the whole thing, our gap is reinsured. We made just a $250,000. Now, thing about reserves though is that they're no longer at our disposal. Capital insurance company, they have to hold on to that. Did dissolve the capital policy. Also sad that if we were to self-insure that company, and then this would be covered in free, so we would have full control of it. So there is something to get up.
Self-insure, and then we're even wearing full of that 20 million. If we have to tap into it and at a later date, you know, for renewal, does that impact the ability for renewal?
I think that if we have a loss in general, that will impact our job. So whether or not it's covered with reinsurance or self-insurance, under both scenarios, we would be challenged that we find a place. I wanted to point out that we are continuing the evaluation process, including the membership agreement that we would need to sign on to if we were to join EIS, ERS. We've been working on that now for a couple of months. We have a meeting even this week to meet with EIS board and more of those details. So it's been kind of a long process, but we haven't had any experience with capital insurance starting from scratch. I think we can see the progress. I think that captive insurance provides access to reinsurance, provides flexibility, and it also can help us structure the program in a way that's an option for the broker that can help with some pricing as well. So we think that following the evaluation process thus far, we need a best position to address current and future volatility in the wildfire liability insurance market. It's like top 30 for sure. So the next steps supportive, continue our due diligence on the cap to sell concept. And then once we completed that work, seek authorization to see how that works. I'm not sure if we need a board authorization at this point, so as part of the evaluation process. We would enter into a participation agreement with the EIS and the RFA. Then your board would vote as a member. They would register as a captive insurer in the state of Washington. And then we would begin to direct EIS purchase of reinsurance. If we decide to choose that option, and we will come back to the board on 17 with a recommendation for the overall insurance program and information on where we're at. And at that point, the board will have the opportunity to vote on the motion, whether or not to ensure that something that happened, include that. So it's a lot up in the air at the moment. And it's primarily due to the changing market conditions that have gone so rapidly. And so it's been the most interesting renewal that I've had to date. If for any reason the cell captive, the EIS cell captive isn't activated until after July 1st, reinsurance purchase at a later date, we aren't able to take the regulatory burden with the cell captive and be able to get the payment of captive insurance.
Hey, yes.
So if we we're not able to overcome the regulatory burdens that are required, the hurdles, it's self-captive. You know, on Washington State. And we've been told by the state that much lower risk.
We need to do that on, it's like a self-insured.
It's as though you have your own insurance company. It is your own insurance. And it's, you know, that's why it's a little more costly to set up, because you have to register with the state and go through conventional steps. Versus if we went with the self-captive, the EIS already has in place, they've already, you know, been through that.
Commissioner, we're not getting you on the phone.
Sorry.
Right, so they would cover all of the administrative involved. If we had our own stand, our agreement would then all of the management. But as those costs aren't spread among the that's why it's $150 per year. They estimate versus $65,000.
Okay, you just answered my question. So that is spread across, the benefit is spread across. The administration side of that is spread across the other members, but it is each of us, if we had a claim, we wouldn't impact anybody else. It's just the spreading of the administration.
Exactly. Got it. And as I said, we're working diligently to make sure that everything they've represented is in fact the case. We're working for the bylaws, the participation agreements. In concerns work.
And we've never done captive, we've never bought captive insurance in the past, or
so I think we did under as a joint partnership, believe it or not, with Chelan Falls Water District back in the early 90s. This for a few years we were trying to meet some RCW definition, and purchased insurance. It says you had to have another partner. So we had our other partnership fall apart. And so I don't know all the details. I didn't arrive until 99 that I heard about what happened. But I don't know that all of the RCWs have been that regulate captives been developed at that time. I think it's a lot more.
As you know, I'm in the industry, and so there are so many questions that I have. I can only imagine the hurdles that you're trying to climb over, because what I see with my own clients that don't have a complex industry, it's still a challenge in our state, and it's getting more and more challenging to get insured. We have carriers that are pulling out regularly, and to the point if you file one claim, good luck finding a carrier from a commercial perspective. In general, what I see is that if you're lucky, you have 3 months to work on a renewal. So I'm curious how long you've been working on this. When did you get your renewal?
Have to wait till the individual files move our potential data process. But you've got this indication from the market which is that they know the extent to which it's changing. Certainly my time here, I've never seen anything like in both expect or being able to find coverage.
And all projections are it is going to get harder. So if you could just talk to me a little bit about your wildfire risk mitigation. And I'm curious on how important the de-energizing lines becomes a component of that.
Well, I can tell you that from an insurance perspective, every single underwriter meeting I was in, they asked if we had plans for the energization process. Where I see it going is that it's going to be, you know, best practices required, especially if you have high risk locations. I think, you know, even if you look at the state wildfire mitigation plan template, they ask about what is their mitigation plan. You know, the work that we've done, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to lead the wildfire mitigation working group. We have a lot of leaders on the group. I'm just mostly organizing and trying to learn as much as I can about wildfire mitigation in the process. I can say that underwriters are impressed in general with the work that if you look at our vegetation management program, all of the things are really important, but the most important thing is they like a program. And that really sets apart a lot of other utilities that are quickly scrambling to develop. When I talk to other utilities in the region, major utilities, that they don't have a program where they're working.
So that seems like it could also cause problem, because when we don't have the lines live and energized, it makes it a challenge to get water to fight fire. Yeah. So are you working with like the local fire departments to make sure that they have a storage that's readily available, or can you speak to that a little bit?
We just have a presentation.
Okay.
Michelle has put together that needs to step on her toes. But I've told Rachel that if I'll remain available in the room, if on those questions.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Kelly indicated that she's in the business, in the insurance business. I imagine everybody in this room at one level or another, it's one of her consumers. Yeah, we all get insurance. Anecdotal information, just to let you know, we're not alone. My wife's family has a small summer place, heavily forested in Montana. We've just been having an online conversation in the last couple of days about some tree root. And I made a comment in that online conversation about, well, we haven't got our insurance bill yet. And from what I'm hearing, you know, that isn't the only expense that's going to go up, the tree removal. And I just got a note from my nephew this morning that our insurance premiums in the last 3 years have gone from $1,700 to $3,300. Fortunately, we still have insurance. But from what you're saying, that may not be the case at some point in time. So, that's just anecdotal information.
The insurance companies have gotten really sophisticated in their wildfire modeling. I've seen some of the results. You don't show up the way I would prefer.
You've come a long way from the last 15 years when our premiums came in so proud of that, those low premiums. We're not there anymore.
Yeah, very true. Changing my attitude, especially I think more with litigation, we're seeing that impact.
I just want to thank you for your intensity in managing this, because it's become a bigger and bigger and more important part of what we do in our everyday operations. Thank you.
Appreciate that. So, Ron, are you looking for something from us? You're going to continue your due diligence, seeing what you can do. Is there anything else you need from us? Because you'll, before you come back to us?
No, I think just getting your general support from the NMOG support is where we're at today, and hopefully we'll have it. It's a certainty that we'll complete the evaluation process.
Before you pull that down, if you want to go back to where is the slide? I'm looking It might be your second slide, wildfire liability insurance. It's the list of the fires. Right there. And I'm gonna defer to Rachel in her presentation. We were up in Plain last week, and we had an absolutely fascinating conversation with a family that lived through the Labor Day fire and lost their home. I'll just leave it there and let you talk about it, Rachel. Okay.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ron. Commissioners, next up, I'd like to call Ms. McGarmont and Rachel Ransom to a deeper dive in the whole fire safety outage management of this commonly known threat is a public safety power shutoff, PSPS. As Ron had mentioned, there's a team that's been working on it. This has consumed a lot of time, district staff, and as needed. You may recall a month or so ago, we did an update on the district performance plan. But we have two goals for this year. One is to look at our coverage. So that was recommended to expand the program. This will be our fourth year. And then the other goal is later this year, we are required by the state to file a fire mitigation plan. So, okay.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Rachel Hansen. I'm from Communications.
And Chris McDarland from System Operations.
So there's no board action required today. This is just for information. Our wildfire mitigation continues to evolve. And our goal today, we're going to start with giving you a bigger context of what's happening in the industry. We're going to zoom into Chelan County, talk about some of the fire assessment work we've done there. And we'll talk about some of the actions that we're taking to address those risks, including fire safety outage management, which is expanding countywide. So there are several catalysts that are driving the evolution of our wildfire mitigation plan. One of them is environmental, meaning longer fire seasons, unhealthy forest ecosystems, and increased population growth in those fire-prone areas. We're also seeing evolving best practices among utility. We've learned a lot in the last 20 years. We have better risk assessments now, better weather forecasting, more case studies, and just a bigger arsenal of tools to address some of the threat of wildfire and build resiliency along the electric. And I think regulatory pressure has been talked about a little bit. Public safety power shutoffs are required for some utilities in California and Oregon. In Washington state, they are not a requirement yet, but they are one element that utilities must consider when they're submitting their wildfire mitigation plans in October. And at Chelan PV, we've had a comprehensive wildfire mitigation plan for several years, and we're going to be well prepared to meet those regulations in October. And also increasing liability. It's one factor of many that's driving the evolution of this plan, but as you just heard, it's quite a serious situation. So zooming into Chelan County, we've contracted with a fire modeling company to assess wildfire risk along our lines. And what you see here is a map of our distribution system. So this assessment, it takes into account the fuels that are present, the historical weather data, historical fire behavior, and population density along our lines. And I want you to take special note here of the orange and red areas. That represents 41% of our distribution system. And we're introducing some additional precautions in those areas for this fire. So our wildfire mitigation plan has multiple objectives. Number one, to protect life and property. Number two, to reduce the risk of ignition from electrical equipment. And also to invest in best practices to protect all of our customers from the impacts of large-scale mitigation. So some of the actions we take to meet those objectives, one of the biggest ones is vegetation management. So we prune trees and shrubs away from our power lines. We do that on a cycle. In high fire danger areas, we do those inspections annually. We also invest a lot in fire hardening to make our electrical grid more resilient. Things like fire-resistant mesh that we wrap around our wooden poles, and we clear vegetation from around our poles, and we're converting more of our transmission structures from wood to steel. And then wildfire mitigation settings, that's something we started in 2021. But in high fire risk areas, we increase the sensitivity of our lines during fire season so that anytime there's a disruption on the line, say a branch or a squirrel hits the line, normally there'd be just a blink and then power automatically restores. Under these wildfire mitigation settings, power would stay off until crews can go and inspect those lines and make sure that it's safe to restore power. So those areas are staying the same for this fire season. It's Kalakum, Novar Cooley, Staten Flats, Blewett, and Lake Wenatchee Plain. Coordination with other agencies. The fact is, wildfire risk in Chelan County is bigger than any one agency can handle on their own. So we support a lot of our partner agencies on things like forest health treatments and water reservoirs. We support a lot of different kinds of efforts around Chelan County to collectively reduce the risk. And then fire safety outage management. I want to emphasize here that this is one small part of our bigger plan, and it's a measure that we would rarely use and only as a last resort. So we'll talk a little bit more about that here later in the presentation. Chris will talk about some of the equipment upgrades.
One of the goals of our wildfire mitigation program is to balance reliability and safety. On the reliability side, we're making investments to reduce impacts to customers, especially in areas where we've increased the sensitivity of our lines during fire season. We're also not resting on our past successes, as Rachel mentioned a number of them. We continue to install animal guarding in areas where we've had issues with wildlife in the past or where we think we may have in the future. We installed fault indicators to help our linemen identify fault locations quicker when they're out patrolling lines to reduce outage durations. And in our highest fire risk areas, we currently adjust relay settings manually, and they remain in the highest sensitivity mode for the duration of the peak fire season. To become more agile, we have installed two new skater reclosers that we are piloting in the Lake Wenatchee and Plain areas this summer. These devices will allow us to remotely switch relay settings depending on daily weather conditions, better isolating outages, and impacting fewer households. We expect the pilot to be successful and plan to invest in more skater reclosers over the next 5 years. The risk study helped us identify 24 unique FSOM zones, pictured here with the outlined areas. During the fire season, May through October, a unique 10-day weather forecast will be provided to us for each of the 24 zones, updated 4 times per day. These forecasts are used to help us plan and communicate potential FSOM events. If you look closely, you may notice that urban areas like the cities of Chelan, Enya, Leavenworth, and Wenatchee are not included in these 24 zones and are not expected to ever experience an FSOM event. That means an expected FSOM event, people who are out of power will have a place nearby to go for shelter and essential services and supplies. 5 types of real-time weather data will also be updated hourly and be provided to us via digital means in and around most zones. This will help us inform real-time decision-making before implementing an actual FSOM event.
In the future, we're looking to invest in more technology to add to our wildfire mitigation plan. One of them is weather monitoring stations along our lines. And we've also, we're starting a pilot program on an AI-driven smoke detecting camera that's on our Natapoc Ridge tower in the Lake Wenatchee area. We're working to add that to Lake Wenatchee Fire and Rescue's Alert West network of cameras. So those are two future technologies that we'll talk to you about in future fire seasons. So fire safety outage management. A fire safety outage is a proactive power outage that's intended to prevent power lines and equipment from sparking a fire that would escape initial attack. So if you can, I'm gonna walk through the process here. If you imagine a hot summer day, let's say it's this. Temperatures are high, there's low humidity, The fuel's tinder dry, there's high burn potential. So early forecasts would show that the potential, there's a potential for dangerous gusting winds. So Chelan PUD in that case would stand up an internal command system where we would monitor that weather data, see if it changes, try to validate some of that data. We'd also let senior management team know, general manager, that the conditions are looking potentially hazardous and that a fire safety outage might be necessary to prevent our equipment from being a source of ignition. We'll also notify our emergency management partners and our fire districts. And that's important so that we can verify the data that we're seeing in the forecasts and better understand the impacts to individual fire districts. So we'll be working with our partners to have a better situational awareness. And if it appears that extreme conditions appear imminent, we'll notify our customers, ideally with 48 hours in advance to help them prepare, and then again, 24 hours in advance. So once the weather passes, and as soon as it's safe to do so, we'll send out our crews to investigate the lines. And this is an important part of the process because when there's extreme winds, it can blow down trees, it can blow down branches, there could be any number of damage done to our lines. So our crews, they need to inspect those lines before we restore power. And depending on the size of the area that's out, how many crews are available, and the time that it takes to repair those lines, fire safety outage could be somewhere between hours or days, depending on the severity and the geographical area that we've taken out. We started with this fire safety outage management program in the Lake Wenatchee area in 2021. That area represents about 3,000 customers. We've never had to use it. We've been blessed with some good snowpack years since 2021. This year, we're going and expanding fire safety outage management countywide. We collaborated with local fire chiefs in Chelan County, and most of them are supportive of this program. We have a common goal here to protect life and property and to prevent a catastrophic fire. And we know how much our customers rely on electricity. There are conditions where the right thing to do is to prioritize safety the risk of electrical equipment starting a catastrophic fire. And by proactively turning on power, we also protect all of our customer owners from bearing the cost of the legal fallout, as we've seen in Oregon and Hawaii and California. So this fire safety outage plan will evolve based on experience, based on what we hear from customers. Over the next month or two, we're going to be going out to communities in a variety of ways to let them know about this program and to listen to concerns. Join us on some community drop-in sessions. That story that Commissioner Smith was talking about was Lake Wenatchee Safety Day, and we met a young family, two young kids that had relocated the plane after losing their home in the Oregon area. That home was completely firewise. The fire happened at around midnight. They lost everything, and they've been in a class action lawsuit against a utility since 2020. But they were emphatically in support of this plan, knowing how devastating the impacts could be from a fire. So that was a really powerful personal anecdote that we heard of as we're starting to do communications. So three key messages we want our customers to know. Number one, that the decision to use fire safety outage is rarely used measure of last resort. And number two, that our notifications, our goal is to alert customers 48 hours in advance. And number three, that there's a number of things they can do to be prepared. They can sign up for Everbridge emergency alerts through Chelan County Emergency Management. They can update their contact information with the PUD so we know how to get a hold of them. They can create an emergency outage plan for their home or their business. You know, maybe consider backup generation. That's an option. And for customers who rely on electricity for their medical equipment at home, that's something that we need to know about. So we have an electrical medical needs registry that they can sign up for at chelandmedia.org. So with that, we do have a webpage with a lot more information about fire safety outages. And if you have constituents who have questions, they're welcome to contact us. Have any questions from commissioners?
Brandon?
Yeah, a question emerged in my mind over the course of this presentation, and it may not be able to be answered here. A few months ago, we had a presentation at the Tri-Commission meeting regarding the addition of Doppler radar that could capture areas that currently we don't get good data from, because this whole program is driven by needing good data to determine if and when power is going to get shut off. Has there been any advances on that, or does anybody?
Yes, we did meet in that company, and they certainly highlighted their successes in areas that have tornadoes and hurricanes and things like that. And they are looking at siting some additional radar capabilities that they use, I think, for higher frequency Doppler radar versus the longer wave that's used by the weather service. So they can get a little bit more detail, but we're kind of in a gap between Seattle and Spokane on that,
right?
But what we're looking at, we're still evaluating that. So I'll leave that at that. I will say that regardless, we may want to add some more smaller weather stations that really provide that wind detail in real time in specific areas that we're looking at for each part zone. So that's probably something that we will certainly look at, both of those options. Thanks for bringing that up.
So, commissioners, I'd like to just mention one thing. We will be hiring a wildfire program manager. That's just, we've got a pretty large team, a successful team. We also recognize the fact that we need your help. So that was part of the budget that was approved. So process now, hopefully starting that position, that will really be key in a lot of these coordination efforts and working with public agencies and our customers. So more to come on that.
Any other questions? I know we have some people from the community. Come on up to the microphone, sir. State your name and address. And
I don't want to. Randy Whitehall, purchase in the Yankee Valley, 712 Indian River Road, also a fire commissioner for District 8. Thanks, Rachel, for coming up to finish your presentation, and I apologize for the reception you received. A lot of interest in the Valley for that. The Shaw, regardless of whether it's a limited use or any use, you know, there's a couple of questions we've had in regard to that. And one of those that Rachel can answer for us was, using the criteria you have, how many fires have been started by the PUD using that criteria? How big did they get? You know, is that part of your risk analysis? Because I gotta say, your reliability is pretty good. We pulled the folks there at the district. Not a whole lot of fires being started by the PUD because I think of the maintenance and the activities you're doing, which is, I commend you. Another question we had was, because the Indian Valley is fairly secluded, we have no phone service to cut power. So people up the valley have no way to contact anybody for an emergency, even if it's not a PUD emergency. There's no phone system. There's no cell coverage. We don't have cell towers in Dania. So just want to know, what kind of analysis did you do for that liability if people can't get out to get emergency services that are not related to the PUD? Car accidents, the neighbors using their generator starts a fire, but you can't call the fire department now. Power's out. So just want to know if there's some of that, well, that was the thought process going into your, why we're going to turn the power on. The second or another item was, are we looking at doing a better job of removing the vegetation underneath the power lines? Because I see a lot of the same crews come back year after year to cut the same trees year after year. I'm thinking you could probably do a lot more of elimination under the power lines to not have to actually come back every year to where every other year to prune and pay for that as a cost saving, I could say. You could do a one-time job, clear the lines, not have that issue. Is there any liability for the public who owns the land adjacent to the power plant? They have a responsibility to do fuel treatments and maintain those fuel treatments in conjunction with your right of way. You know, so if there's trees that are hazardous on the lines, private landowner have a responsibility to have those removed? Or is that strictly a PUD responsibility? You know, so I mean, that could cause an outage, right? But it's not something you guys would worry about because it's not your responsibility. It's the landowner's responsibility. The landowners know that. So let me check my notes. My granddaughter's notepad here. Yeah, that pretty much covers the highlights that I have. Just looking at some feedback. And we already have numerous landowners up there that can't get insurance at all. Some have been canceled this year because of that. And I would just caution you on the use of the state insurance agent, the commissioner. I hope you get better access, better information from them, because I got no information from this, trying to work with them because I got canceled on one of my rental properties. It sits in the middle of 40 acres of orchard, but got canceled because it was in a high wildfire risk area. And you could not even talk to them because their little black box says you're in a high fire risk. They couldn't answer any of my basic questions. Where's the spotting potential from? What's causing the fire? What's the fuel load they're using? What's the direction? You know, what's the wind direction normally going to be? They said it's all part of our black box. You don't have any. It's all proprietary information. Cannot use it. Cannot get the information. The commissioner, the insurance commissioner, couldn't get that information from insurance companies either. So hopefully you'll get better active participation from the state insurance commissioner, but I doubt it. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for your questions that we've been reported. I would just like to say thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing great comments. And understand that we're really at the beginning of this process and we want to work with the community. We're glad you're here. We want to hear what you have to say. Your ideas help us. We listen. And it helps us as we move forward to develop a plan that will work for the communities and for the individual landowners, as well as help protect the PUD from its liability. And so we walked this path together. And so I thank you for your comments. And hopefully as we develop teams involving community members, that you'll be an active participant in that to help us go forward to develop a plan that is at effect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, I could respond with some of the early names. Is that okay? Let me just share quickly. If you had a number of questions, I'll try to go quickly. We have been fortunate that we have not had any issues during high wind. That is not to say that we haven't had any issues. They do happen. It's impossible to provide power to as many customers as we can and not have ignition events, no matter, no utility can conflict. During the high wind events, they need to prevent catastrophic loss. So, but we have been fortunate. Other utilities, not as much. If you look at the Gray Fire that happened east, west of Spokane last August, and unfortunately, two fatalities, over 250 homes burned. It's absolutely can happen if you have power being supplied. When it comes to are in the process of expanding the road equipment to that area. Terms of being able to obtain the water, we're not going to have, we don't expect to have any of these upcoming events in the city limits. So hopefully wells will be available in the city limits. And certainly there's a lot of details that they need to work through. I know that there've been discussions with cell phone companies about them having back at February. This is a complicated process. General Electric for their, what they call public safety, planning process. So we're trying to learn from others as well.
Questions or comments? Thank you. Go ahead. Thanks, Tony Powers, 458. And so you guys have done a lot of research, and so I would guess a specific number of how many events were caused by the power stuff in the last 10 years and it locked into Morgan, Idaho. Close to one, whether it's five or whether it's five.
I don't know that we have the exact number of how many ignitions there are or how many catastrophic fires there are, but we know they can happen. And so we certainly don't want to be the source of an ignition in our county.
Correct.
You know, even if it's the first one.
But of course, but a car wreck can happen too, and we keep driving every day. So it seems like we're trying to mitigate liability for the PUD by shutting them off power to the people that pay the PUD. So you're taking their services. And not have any liability. It seems like a counterproductive way to get rid of liability, maybe taking away the stuff that down would be a much better way to do it, and then your customers aren't impacted at all. I think that's
you know, a great question and a great point, and that's why we have a multi-pronged approach to this. We don't just rely on turning off power.
Yeah.
This is certainly something that's becoming mandated that we have to have. I did write down some of the concerns, and so I'm wondering how we might be able to mitigate some of those things. Certainly,
yeah.
Even if you're driving a car, you do things to mitigate your risk.
Right.
We know we can't get rid of all risk. It would be the only way we can mitigate all risk is just not to provide service, and that's obviously not what we're going to do.
Right.
So one of the things we are doing, though, is figuring out how do we mitigate risk? How do we reduce risk? But getting rid of all liability.
Like this gentleman said, you know, that in city limits, well, water isn't going to be an issue, but we're talking 10 miles from in yet. I'm in 7, and there's people that are 20 miles up. You lose power, you have no water and no communications. If you're 25 miles up, that's a 30-plus drive to get to where you can call for help. And now everything's gone. They lose everything, their animals, home. Possibly a family member that had a heart attack and came to therapy and fucked their aid. You know, there is no cell service anywhere. If you haven't been up there to try to use a cell phone, you should try it. But, you know, so shutting off power is a big deal because you can run, even if yours is off, or your Wi-Fi isn't working, you can go to a neighbor who has the same thing, then now you can get it. But power, no power, everybody's shut off.
So if we were to implement an SM event in the Ardmore area, how can we mitigate your other concerns?
I'm not sure. If you cut the power off, the whole thing's coming from everything. Nobody has water and nobody has communications.
So what's your biggest concern? Is it the communication part? If there was some other way to communicate?
If there was another way to communicate, then yeah. Stop, and still have. They have today's live animals and livestock and things like that. If we depend on the water, now even animals that are getting hot, will heat, things like that. So there's a lot of other factors that cutting off power really, really affects. That, you know, like I can grab my family and my dogs, and I can go down to the facility that has supplies, but you can't grab your cows and go do that.
they're just going to start running into some major issues.
Valid concerns, serious concerns, and you have a right to bring those up. So thank you for being here.
May I ask a question? Is that great? So for your community, given that there are so many concerns with being so rural, do you have like a handheld radio system where you guys communicate typically?
No.
I know. So there are like in Chelan, there's a group of people that they coordinate, they work together to have handheld radio so that should something happen, it's just like a backup source of communication.
I mean, that's a possibility. But it's to be getting something like that to be able to communicate.
And I'm not talking about this specific, but if there is.
Yeah. No, that would be a great idea if you communicate to whole valley to get two-way radios and get on the channel. So there's some other issues too.
I do want to add one clarifying thing too. If these events lasted multiple days, it wouldn't be because we were choosing to keep the power out. It would be because there was so much damage to the lines and there would be a restoration of them.
Yeah.
And so if it did last something like that, again, it would be no different than had we had the line in service, and we're taking that long to repair.
Yeah, I was just referring to the city. We sent out to check it out.
Yeah.
So if it goes, you guys shut it off for 2 hours, and now you got to have crews inspect the entire Indiana River Valley, and then we'll take through to inspect all the lines in the Indiana River Valley. It seems like a lot of lines to check. So even at that, you're talking 48 hours, no damage.
It depends which area it is. We're going to be doing a tabletop exercise where we're going to determine that during the next month or so for how long it takes to do this. We'll have a lot better. We're talking some generalizations right now.
Yeah. Because,
you know, we've been doing this in Lake Natchez Plain, but we haven't done it in the area.
Right.
And so as we expand in there, we're looking for more data points. And so understanding customer concerns and what our capabilities are in those areas are certainly things we're trying to determine.
And I know you guys said you hadn't even used it in the Plain area, so I would expect once it is used that there's going to be more complaints and concerns from that area also, because they haven't experienced it yet. A lot of them probably don't even know about it until this morning. I didn't even know that this was a possibility. And you said it's been on the plan for the last 3-4 years, so it's concerning.
So that's why we're trying to do more communication as we expand this out. But we've hit that area a lot. And I don't know if Rich would like to make any comments. I take up too much of the rest of the agenda, but I know that we've been communicating with them with direct mailings and things like that for the last few years. So I would hope that everyone in that area is aware of it.
Had this program just in the Lake Wenatchee Plain area since 2021, we've communicated with that community over many years. The expansion is moved this year. So we're working on communicating that to the rest of the county in the next couple of months. And I do think that there's a point to be made here that the kinds of conditions we're talking about, high wind event, it's likely that the, you know, trees would break and that an outage would happen anyway. So this is a good conversation to have about preparedness, whether or not we these kinds of conditions would likely result in an outage anyway. So it's good to kind of work through this emergency preparedness ahead of them.
To mitigate their risk by shutting it off ahead of time, when we could just prevent the outage to start with this year. And then, but I understand insurance and all that kind of stuff is hard to get and expensive. So.
Anything, I'm gonna, I would stop it. I'm gonna stop this special panel of seven people who want to comment.
I would just like to point out this is a wonderful conversation, good conversation to have with the community. Thank you, Tony. But I also want to bring clarity to what we're talking about. And we're talking about a weather event, and only in a matter of extreme weather event that would be accompanied with high wind would we contemplate turning off power. In an event such as high wind, whether we draw power or not, let's say we don't, tree comes down on the line, you still don't have power.
Correct.
So, what I would suggest to the community, and I think this is something that should be voiced throughout the entire county, is that we live in an area where, especially if it's treed area, there's the possibility of wildfires. I live at Fourth Ridge. Every year when I hear the helicopters go overhead, I run out and see if it has a bucket. But I choose to live there. And I live there because I like it. And I'm willing to accept that risk. But I got one way in, one way out, school truck. If that road was shut down because of a wildfire, we've been told by the fire department, our place of refuge is Mission Ridge parking lot. You hunker down in the center of the parking lot and hope you don't get burned. And so I think we all have to kind of realize that with respect to whether the PD turned off power or not, you have that risk every day, every whether it's wintertime or summertime. And so we own that risk by choice of where we live. So it's really not so much whether we turn off the power, because the power could still go out.
We don't need to add to the risk by cutting the power.
Well, but my point is,
choosing to live up there.
So I just want to close by saying that we have some risks, and we need to realize the limited nature of times in which we're contemplating even turning off power.
We have some additional questions and comments.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. Willie Hill on the 91. I agree with a lot of what Tony had to say here. We live in a very isolated area, absolutely no cell reception. Our shut down and real hardship for a lot of people up there. But my point that I'd like to bring out to the board is I've been in the building code development business for 35 years. And I've been involved back in state code development, national code development, all development. And I just urge this group to be careful that don't broadcast this. Yeah, you can point to the Spokane files. Is there anything in that Spokane fire that resembles of any antibody? No. There's a complete different set of geographics over there. You can always point to the worst case scenarios. We develop building code because if somebody has a knee-jerk reaction or some industry gets up there and said, well, we think we need this, and it goes for it. And the code, when I started in building code was that big. It was that big now with three volume, trying to accommodate everything. Gone beyond the realm of reasonabilities. So I just want to encourage the board that you really do look at this. Come up with a matrix, you know, where does Enneat Valley stack up in the way of severability to other areas that could have this problem before you start, you know, and I'm sure you will. I know you're going to do your due diligence. We had the state urban wildland interface code that got pulled this year by the state building code council. It was due to go into effect March 15th. It's been pulled. It's no longer out there. It's gone back to the table to be reworked because there were so many flaws in it. DNR communicating with the local counties, statewide, it just wasn't coming together. And so that was a good example instead of just moving forward with it and throwing a broad brush out there to putting in all these new statewide mitigation measures for homeowners and new construction. They backed off on it and said, we better take a look at this a little closer. That's what I encourage you to do.
Thank you very much. Next speaker.
Karen Whitehall, 6712 Enneat River Road. And looking at the web page, Steve's been to at least 7 meetings up in the Lake Wenatchee Plain area, visiting with folks up there, and I'd encourage the commissioners to visit with their individual areas. Again, you present this to their constituents. What is going on? The Chelan County CWTP group is currently just getting started in how they are going to talk about recommendations for what the landscape should look like. And perhaps the lower risk areas under the utility line should be part of that. And you guys could get involved in the CWPP. And if the landowners knew what the low risk looked like, perhaps they would add that onto their properties. And the last one, knowing how countywide, if it is like in Chilena County and how the power gets turned back on, every single time, any has been less. The plane, we would actually say the homes have been before us. The Lake Chilena second homes have been before us. We are always last. And White Orchard will not be happy in the middle of summer if it's last. So thank you.
Quick question. I'm not familiar with the acronym CWPP.
Community Welfare Protection Fund.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Whitehall, we are involved in that, in the development of that.
If folks could understand what low risk would like, we might be able to.
And I have two clarifications, if I may. One is that I don't think PUD looks at is just a PUD problem or PUD risk. I think you look at it as community risk and our risk together. The other thing I think bears pointing out is that it came up as far as restoration goes, we're going to be restoring as we inspect. So we'll start at the substations, and as we go out, we'll have devices open on the way. So we won't be inspecting the entire system and then start restoring. We'll inspect that first section, and if it's good, we'll energize and start inspecting the next section. So we'll be energizing as we go. So even if something did last more than 24 hours, some people would be getting on, you know, very quickly. So just if that helps mitigate some of the concern, I want to get that.
At this point, we are going to continue on with our agenda to get everything finished. I want to thank everybody for your comment. You have one more question? Got to make it quick.
Randy Dahl, 662 Indian River Road. Basically, you can operator here. Relay projection is a big part of it. It's mentioned that currently wind is changing setting for relays. I think that it's really got to be indoors. If you take a look at relay settings and stuff like that, it reduces the liability to get the cap to go through the cluster. Putting in local wind generation or wind monitors to help determine when to shut the tower off and when to turn it back on. And I think a big question is what cost the pipe is to make the determination to shut the tower off. And at what point at the same time, or how they're doing it, because we had forecast.
So obviously forecasts are forecasts. And so we'll spin up our communication and communicate with fire districts and with our community members, our customers, when we have one forecasted. But we won't actually implement unless we see that occur in real time. And so it's obviously a really difficult decision to turn the power off because it's not something we want to do. But it's something at some point, well, we feel that we really need to. And so those wind speeds are speeds that, you know, I think it's something we have to look at the time it occurs. And there's other factors too. Wind gusts are certainly one of them, but I think it would certainly be over 40 miles an hour, something higher than that, because we're looking at what speed can damage the trees or blow things up into the line. So even if the line doesn't come down, something might get blown into line, catch fire, and then drop to the ground. So we're obviously concerned about that. And so it's those speeds that they can break branches, knock trees down. So it's really those really higher wind events that might lead to an event like that.
Communication part of the fiber optics. Fiber optics.
Batteries. Really big. Batteries not working.
Yeah, you can put small security.
Let's move here to get her.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate the comments. We're working really hard to make sure that this is done well. We're doing everything we can to help assure people's safety. And yet we realize the impact of cutting that electricity off. It's not just a liability issue. It's really about doing what we need to do to keep people safe. And we're going to continue to work on that. And your comments today help provide that guidance. So I appreciate you being here today. We will continue to work on it. See us up in the valley to continue to talk about these plans in the future. And that's our commitment. So thank you very much. Appreciate the presentation today. All right, John, let's move on to item number 5.
Sure, I'd like to call it Felicity Saber and Dave Nelson. This is a continuation of a standing strategic vision, business and budget plan. We had a focus on public power benefit and some feedback received at the last meeting.
We're here in response to meeting last week, or I guess actually now May 20th, to talk about some of the feedback we received from the board regarding the public power benefit program funding. Today we'll be introducing the feedback to make sure that we got it right. This is a board funded program. We want to make sure we're incorporating your feedback in terms of the resolution and moving that program forward. We'll do a quick review of the financial criteria and funding, and then lastly, maybe confirm with the board's direction so that we can come back with a resolution. At our last board meeting, feedback from you all included a desire to extend funding for the program, but to modify some of the elements of that program. We'll be reviewing the highlights today of how this program is currently funded, clarify what we have, make sure that we're on board with it. See? Making sure that our everything's included in there. Our board approved funding currently is through 2024. We have approved that with our strategic planning cycle of $6 million per year. Each year we validate whether or not that meets our financial criteria and make sure that we have that going forward. Any unused funding in each allocation year is not carried forward. We did make an exception in 2024 for funding. The board did request that we move that forward. This hasn't been an issue in years past. We have been able to fully allocate all of the funding in the prior years of this planning cycle. Projects proposals are accepted year round, and we have established a committee of district staff and 2 commissioners that meet annually to evaluate projects that have been submitted and recommend them to the board for approval. Here, the desire to move forward with a number of items in the program, specifically the annual funding to be supported by our financial results and future financial projections. Second, to keep the solicitation open year round. And third, to continue with the staff recommendation through a committee in this year. However, we did hear also that we would like to amend a couple of items in that, establishing annual program funding rather than having it set at a fixed amount per year to establish that amount on the basis based on financial criteria. And second, to allow that program to carry over into future years. That would also necessitate putting a program fund together so that if it wasn't spent in the upcoming year, that it could be spent in future years where there's a timeline necessarily associated with that. The financial criteria, I'm just going to give a quick summary of that. It includes a look back and a look forward. If you have additional questions, you can ask me about that. But the 5-year average of our net bottom line is what we use on the look back period. Those are audited results. And then on look forward, we look at our projections, our financial projections, and ensure that our defined financial criteria is being met based on those projections. And then we also evaluate our debt, trying to make sure that we're not
over time. We have stipulations that do not be stepped necessary.
Our finance team has completed a review of 2025 funding, and the $6 million that we've done in the past does meet our criteria and pass all. We can also fund around that for future. Staff also had some additional recommendations that we wanted to bring forward as well. If we did incorporate a fund balance that is held going forward, we'd also like to include the review of that fund balance in the financial criteria on an annual basis. The district process for determining what resources we have available to complete projects, we'd also like to use that more actively with our public power benefit projects. Historically, the board has set those in advance, and then we run those through later and often have to come back with different results maybe that aren't meeting what board expectations are. So we want to be able to have a more clear expectation around that, which includes more accurate assessment of resources, funds, and also our project staff necessary. And then lastly, the staff also recommends setting the allocation on an annual basis. This would allow both the financial criteria as well as the result from our the work we've done with our project management teams to determine whether or not we have an allocation of staff to do that work current year and make a recommend schedule and budget allocations.
One slide. You say, look back to audited financial results, considering the 5-year average bottom line. Because you're looking at financial criteria. The question that's in my mind is, wait, and we had this conversation 2 weeks ago, that many years ago, 10 years ago, I guess it was, when we established this, we were, and Gary, you labeled it well, crawl before you can walk, walk before you can run. But we had also talked about a number that would seem to be about right with around 10% of our net profit, for lack of better terms, at the end of the year. What financial criteria are you looking back at this moment in time that validates that we're in the 6 million, to quote, right number?
What we do and what's in the resolution talks about the bottom line and specifically looks at it in comparison to the debt coverage ratio. So we want to make sure that we can cover our debt service. So the covenants associated with our bond require us to maintain 1.25 coverage, for example. So in the unusual conditions, we want to make sure we have at least that 1.25 coverage, and then the excess of that is what we apply the 10% to the criteria that we looked at, say. What would that look like? What are available after meeting the deadline? That. We also look forward, same criteria, looking at that. And we also look at our expected case and say, what is the amount available above the 2%? Because that's really what we as a district, that's our financial covenants we want to, our metrics that we've set for ourselves. We want to be above what the debt bond covenants require. We don't want to get close to that. So we want to make sure we have a good margin of for that. So we're looking at determining the amounts available for public power benefit after considering the public.
Right. Understood. $6 million meets all the criteria. What other number meets all the criteria? That's the key question. Does 10 million meet that? Does 20 million meet that?
So for the most recent, I believe the lowest amount, if you look at the minimum of the different criteria established, 10% of the 77 million was 8. So 10% of that would be off 7.
We can do the math. Because we've had in the last several years, significant
Yeah, and I can get you the detail of the potentially of what the debt probably requirement and what the expectations are.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That clarification helps.
That we'd like to confirm board direction for the resolution of the future. Staff is recommending $60. That's the next budget here. We'd also like to recommend establishing the program and fund to allow any unallocated funds to be earned through bridge infusion in other necessary spend. And staff had brought forward a number of other items appropriate. Evaluation of fund balance in our financial criteria. We have not historically been, even though we've been able to allocate on an annual basis, we have not come up with the spending. So a lot of that is because we don't have the resources or that grows over time, and we just want to make sure that we're not giving that too far so that we're not funding projects and what that does too, push it out, obviously, it's cost go up over time. You have less clarity regarding switches. And lastly, is to kind of set that amount on an annual basis as we set anything that's been out on the 2020 to the 2024 period. Just want to check, are we on track with what we'd like us to see in that position?
So I appreciate the listening to the conversations prior and coming back to us with what you've heard and recommendations moving forward. Commissioners, are they on track and move forward? Very good. You got a head nod.
Thank you, and we will be back.
Great. Thank you very much. Hey, John, let's move into item number 6. It's
Quality Lodge. It's the street redevelopment. I can understand in the process.
Good morning, Commissioners. David Lodge, Project Management Manager. Here to give an update on some further developments on 5th Street. We got a photo of some of the demolition occurring that the YMCA is performing downtown. So the reason we're here today is to present provisions for a purchase and sale agreement with Music Theater of Wenatchee. If you recall, Music Theater is owns and operates the Riverside Playhouse directly adjacent to our site. And so they've been part of our planning process for the duration, and we're ready with the purchase and sale agreement to come up to the board. I also want to give them a chance. I've got board members here, give them a chance to give some comments about their plans for the facility and then make some recommendations for next steps. I know I was just here a month ago and gave you a long history of how we got here, but I'm going to do it again because it's important to set context. So in 2022, we worked with community partners to get proposals for the site that were in line with the community vision plan. And those proposals did include a portion of the project that would be developed by Music Theater. But we chose not to go with those because they didn't meet the full vision and redevelopment goals of the district. So in early 2023, board directed staff to start discussions with the YMCA and Music Theater and to continue to evaluate options for the remaining site. And in December of last year, we authorized purchase and sale agreement with the Y, and then just last month presented plans for Electric Avenue, which give us context to finalize the purchase and sale agreement with Music Theater. So the proposed purchase and sale agreement, the Music Theater purchases approximately 29,000 square feet of the southern portion of the campus, which is the Fish and Wildlife Building and the adjacent parking lot, for the expansion of the Riverside Playhouse operations. So for consideration, we did an appraisal of the property, and we did the appraisal as if vacant, so no buildings on site, and that came to $546,000. So this was the same methodology we used for the YMCA purchase sale agreement. So the proposed sale price, $546,000. Some of the key terms, PUD is going to construct the roadway and sidewalk through the site, providing circulation to campus. So that's our electric avenue. And then that electric avenue is actually going to extend through what is currently the edge of the fishing wildlife that building and loading dock. So the PUD will perform demolition of the eastern portion of that building and connect the roadway through. For all of this, we endeavor to coordinate with the activities in the playhouse that have ongoing operations. So some other items, PUD will be assuring creation of a commercial owner association for maintenance of the common areas. So we've already established the covenants, conditions, and restrictions on the property, but we'll be further developing the commercial owner association bylaws. And all of this will happen before closing, so that the proposed purchase and sale agreement would be closing on or before December 31st of next year, 2025. The site map, so we're talking about the property that is the Fish and Wildlife Building, but as you can see, the electric avenue will run past that. So even though we've got some time, we are eager to get this piece of the project locked down, and so is Music Theater. And we invited them today to share some of their plans for the site. So we've got Vicki Michael and John Mauser, board members of Music Theater. You guys like to give just a brief introduction of what your plans are for the site.
I haven't been here several times. Still sketchy. I'm Vicki Michael, representing Music Theater of Wenatchee. I've been the chairperson for the Fifth Avenue Campus Committee. I'd like to thank all of you to begin with. It's been a long, long road. We started this with Daniel Frazier, who's now retired. That's how long it's been, in 2018. And we're very excited to bring what we figure is a value to our downtown by the expansion of Music Theater. What we do in the space, we do it now, is literally almost impossible. So having that extra space that we can do our work in will be extremely valuable to us and the arts community downtown. I do believe we bring a huge value to the businesses downtown. Just in Greece, I don't really have the numbers of how many shows we sold out, but I'm guessing it was about 80% completely sold out, 10 night run of over 550 people seats per night going into downtown, eating dinner, drinking, you know, whatever people do when they go to our shows. But to have that extra space so we can make these shows more cohesive and more shows for the public is just amazing. I'd like to thank all of you in this whole long drawn out process, especially you, David.
I don't have much to add to that. We do really appreciate this, and it has been quite a ride. It's been a lot of ups and downs along the way. We are not at the end, but you can see it from here. We do have a lot of ideas. I've kind of been leading the effort to determine what we're going to use the space for, and a lot of ideas have developed over the years. As Vicki indicated, we are just to the gills in the current space that we have. We just have no space for a lot of the other things we would like to do, or things we would like to be able to offer other arts groups to be able to do. There's very little time. We have outside groups who would like to come and perform in our space, rehearse in our space. We don't have any room in our schedule because we are just using it continuously. But if we have space where we can rehearse in the current Fish and Wildlife space or something like that, that would open that up to other organizations. So we're really looking forward to all that extra rehearsal space, extra storage space, things like that. Lots of ideas, and we're really excited about it going forward. So thank you so much.
Thanks, John. It's nice to hear you've got a good problem to try to figure out. So that's great. Appreciate you being here today. And it's really good to see John. I haven't seen John for several years. We used to work together. So thank you very much.
So we're not looking for any action today, but we would like to come back to the next board meeting on June 17th with a resolution to authorize general manager to enter into a purchase and sale agreement. And we're excited about what Music Theater brings to our redevelopment process. The energy created at Riverside Playhouse and the expansion, along with the YMCA, is really fulfilling our commitment to downtown to redevelop this area.
Great. Well, we're very excited to get that finished and excited about the future. So, commissioners, anything else you want to add to that? We will see you on the 17th.
See you then.
Final agreement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan.
At this time, I'm going to open it up to any additional public comment. If we have any before we recess for lunch.
Commissioner, I have two quick manager items if there's enough time.
I think so, John.
Okay. I'd like to call up Ron Slaybaugh. Yeah, it's going to bring forward just something that's going on with region and sale of some surplus land at this community.
Commissioner Ron Slaybaugh, Water and Wastewater Manager. As you know, FUNPUD is one of three members of the regional water system. Regional owns a parcel land over in East Wenatchee, occupied well by well number 7. It was identified as an emergency backup well, not used regularly. It was acquired when East Wenatchee Water District joined regional back in the late 1990s. The Douglas County has approached regional and requested the purchase 10 feet on the front of that property that runs Cascade Avenue for transportation improvement projects, includes widening sidewalk stormwater improvements. So the offer is for $15,200 for just under 2,000 square feet, 1,920 square feet. If that. Any questions, comments, or concerns?
No disruption to anything that we're doing.
Now, the parcel itself is, it's trapezoidal shape. It's roughly 350 feet deep, with the well being located to the west end of that parcel. So it's much larger than what regional actually needs.
Exactly where is this property? Is it on Cascade, down by their facilities building, bottom of 19th Street, that area?
Yeah, bottom of 19th, so just north of 19th.
Okay.
So right. It is to the, west of Cascade, and it's bounded by their roof barrel.
That's great. Yeah, I know the area. Thank you.
Yep.
I'd like to call up Justin Linnea, who's got a potential budget revision he'd just like to present to the board as an onerous.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. It's with Cornia, Supervisor of Network Operations for Fiber and Telecom, standing in for Chris Blaney. So I'll try to keep this brief, but we're looking to do a budget revision. This is related to changing out a subset of the MNTs on the fiber network. We've identified the resources necessary in that effort that is beyond what's considered standard of one app. As always, our goal is to offer world-class broadband services to the customers from Wayne County and ensure that our network remains robust, fast, and reliable. Some of you may be aware, we have recently been experiencing operational issues with the first generation on OMTs. These OMTs have caused some repeated interruptions to our customer owners, and as such, we'll be looking to replace approximately 4,000 affected OMTs. I would also like to add that besides these service interruptions, another major benefit in changing out these OMTs is new devices will allow us to give expanded service offerings. Such as multimedia services to additional customers of Shenandoah County.
Just those are the units that go
on the side of the
side of the house.
Yes, that's correct.
Questions, comments? Thanks for the update.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jason.
John?
That concludes manager items.
Well, this time we will recess for lunch and we'll be back at 1 p.m. Thank you very much. Good afternoon and welcome to the June 3rd business session of the Salem County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices you have today. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically. If you wish to speak, when recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit the comment to 3 minutes. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us, which includes items 13 and 15. Do I have a motion?
Move to approve.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. John, let's continue on with any other manager items that you may have.
I think we hit all those, so I think we're ready to move into your regular resolutions.
Right, so let's, I jumped ahead, sorry, thank you.
So we have...
That was a nice way to say, get on practice. Okay, so we are on resolution number 11.
Yes, I'd like to invite everyone to Nelson. This is a resolution authorizing amendment to Community Services Agreement, SA 21-11618, with Piston Service of Wenatchee, doing business as Jerry's Auto Supply for the provision of operational services and staffing to the district's fleet services parts warehouse.
Good afternoon now. My name is Tony Nelson. I'm the director of our central maintenance, which also includes fleet the fleet services, and I brought things with me. So Lance and I are here for the resolution amendment number 3 to contract 2021-11618. So this resolution provides the approval of amendment number 3 contract with Jerry's Auto Supply to operate the parts warehouse for our fleet services. A little history behind that. In 2017, the district entered a contract with NAPA to operate the district's fleet services, parts rooms, including ownership, management, inventory, and staffing. Jerry's Auto Supply purchased Wenatchee Valley NAPA business in 2019. So in 2021, the Sourcewell contract reissued to Jerry's Auto Supply this current agreement, and which expires in December of 2024. So the terms of the amendment are to extend the duration of the agreement to the end of 2025 and add funds to the contract to cover both the extension and the increased cost in 2024 and 2025 related to changes in the Washington State minimum wage and labor laws. So the annual maximum payment obligation is being adjusted from $185,000 to $200,000 for 2024. And in 2025, $210,000. The total contract amount is being increased by $340,000. For a new not to exceed amount of $818,558. Any questions?
It has nothing to do with, I don't think we need to approve this, but mentioned something that caught my attention, and that has to do with minimum wages. How does that impact us?
Just the increase of it, and so we have they have an exempt employee. And because of the new laws, it's increased the minimum wage, and then we pay it 2 times for the exempt employee, which is included in 2024. And by 2028, I believe it goes 0.5 times the minimum wage.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah.
It's been a phenomenal partnership. Yeah. Oh, I bet it has it. No, they've got expertise. Absolutely. Yeah, we've actually seen a lot of additional benefits from partnering with them that we didn't originally foresee, so it's worked out very well. I'd like to say that we're very pleased with the new operation field. It's our privilege and honor to have the facility to work here. So, thank you.
Okay.
I just have kind of a tactical question. The increase is driven by wages, not the cost of parts. Is that right?
Correct.
Correct. So with inflation, are they able to, does Jerry's actually inventory the parts, or does Jerry's get the parts within a short window of time if we're needed?
They own all the inventory. They actually purchased the previous district's inventory of parts. A lot of that was already in obsolescence, so we're bringing in current. Our fleet is predominantly new, and so a lot of our parts are OEM parts, which are more reliable and sustain the fleet a lot longer than some of the aftermarket parts that we get. But we only get as needed, so we don't. The district doesn't get charged until it goes across the counter.
But I have another question that kind of you said something that sparked my process of thinking here. Is that the newer fleet? Our fleet vehicles, do they have a warranty like a normal car?
They warranty as any other vehicle. A lot of the times you can get a delayed warranty. If we purchase a vehicle and it goes out for updating, we don't have it serviced right away. You can delay that warranty, which is an advantage to us. So it's not just expiring as a sitting here being fitted.
Thank you. I'm learning a lot from you guys. Thanks.
It's a lot to learn.
Back to Gary's question, you know, they do have stock items there, but the other benefit about NAPA is that 9 other stores that we have access to, so we don't have that part, they are able to get it to us fairly quickly.
Great.
Right.
Good partnership. Yeah, it fit in.
So it made me realize the other day as I was doing a walk through the whole building for a YMCA activity, I thought, wow, this is really an old building. And it made me realize that I have a true tour of the new building.
Oh, please do. Things are amazing. Yes.
Any other questions? John, do you have any? Should we just lump these together?
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Okay, the next agenda, item 12, I'd like to call Glenn Spire. It's a resolution ratifying field work order change order number 1, field change order 2, the jump operator switchyard and transmission line construction, bid 23-12828 with Michael Specific Energy Incorporated tomorrow.
Thanks, Jim. Good afternoon. I see you on the Teams meeting too, but I'm actually here. Remember that. Just a few bullet items before I get into the nuts and bolts here. So this project is completely funded by the customer, so Microsoft. Microsoft is aware of the changes that are going on here. I've been interacting with them regularly on these. On the same note, the project overall, we're on track to deliver it on time in accordance with the interconnection agreement. So things are going well. In construction currently, it's looking really good. It's taking shape, so that's fun to see. So field work order change order number 1, which was in the amount of $106,200, compensated Michaels for transmission line work that was unclear in the plan set when we issued it. So this resolution ratifies that work order, field work order change order. It also authorizes us to execute change order number 2, which was primarily driven by changes from the issued for bid process to the issued for construction process. So when we issued this bid, we issued it with IFB drawings, knowing that there would be changes coming. We did that to ensure we would meet the schedule for construction and delivery of the project. So we broke it up into kind of 3 general categories of IFC. Number 1 was civil design coordination with Microsoft. So we, throughout that process, ended up needing to do some additional grading and below grade work. Updated equipment design. So again, when we issued the bid, we had some holds in place for manufacturer drawings that came in later. So those impacted foundation sizes, as well as we needed to put some structural fill in for those. Updated electrical design information, and then a small portion of it is for field changes associated with transmission line work. Any questions?
Cool. Thank you.
Next up is Deborah Vaughn. She has a resolution restating, revising policies and delegating authority regarding capital budget approval and budget provisions and rescinding resolution number 09-13433.
Good afternoon. Coming back to you guys today, we were here on May 20th presenting the changes that we saw necessary in the current resolution. Most of those are, or actually all of them are pertaining to the capital and operation budget. The resolution itself outlines the processes and procedures for the delegation of authority that the district management staff has for capital and operation budgets and budget revisions. When we presented those on May 20th, we had board concurrence on those proposed changes. So the primary change that we're asking for is in regard to the authority dollar amounts, increasing that from 500,000 to 3 million for the general manager, and then allowing him to then redelegate up to 1 million to district staff, and that would be through a memorandum to the general counsel. This resolution also updates roles and title changes that were defined in our new organizational structure, and then also some resolution language that was outdated. Any questions? Thank you.
A quick note that today we didn't plan this, but there was a motion, I believe it's still on the agenda, for a budget revision, which actually would be covered by this situation. We go through the same process, same staff review, but the board, we don't have the time with the lag and the delay and the process of putting together a motion and information for the board. Board does still get it in the quarterly recording. So just kind of happened to be one that matched that, and I just thought I would note that.
Thank you. Thanks for calling that out.
It for the regular resolution. So the board has preference to approve and then put in the motion.
So we're going to do 11, 12, and 14. We'll come back and get 16.
Yeah. Okay. I would take a motion to approve 11, 12, and 14.
Any discussion? All those in favor of approving 11, 12, and 14, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
That takes us to the budget variance that Dave Nelson just spoke about. So I'll call up Gary Rice, who will present more details. I believe we have a proposed motion.
We do.
To bring up.
Case.
We wouldn't have gotten to see you though, Gary.
There we go. Do you want to cover that? Okay, good afternoon. I'm Gary Rice. I'm the project manager on substation projects, and I was project manager for the North Shore Richland substation. I'm sort of the project developer, project delivery team, recently renamed. I like the new name. This is a budget revision. Probably the last time you'll see us here for this. The project is getting close to energizing. Later this month, we expect to energize it. I'll explain why it's taken so long in a moment. This is just shy of $900,000 budget revision, which is about 9% of the total budget. The total budget will be $10,770,000 once complete. You might have recognized that we were here at the last board meeting on May 20th, and that wasn't to do with the substation, but rather the feeders. So that was also a budget revision, and the feeders were quite a distance that we had to go, and we went underground down the, it was part of the agreement during the outreach process. So those are now in and ready to accept power from the substation when it's completed. The reason we didn't do both budget revisions at the same time was the completion of the substation is lagging where the feeders were, and we're getting close to complete, and we wanted to be able to estimate as closely as we could.
I have a few different items I wanted to talk about that were included in this budget revision. One of them was kind of the story of the switch gear that we received for this. We went through all the normal processes of designing and reviewing, bidding and getting schedules. And upon the inspection of the switchgear, it was discovered that we didn't, was actually early on in the drawings before we went down to inspect it physically. The rooftop bushings were not widely spaced enough, not what we designed. We actually marked up and designed it properly, and we got confirmation they would build it properly, and we found that they didn't. So we had a bunch of internal discussions about whether to accept the narrower bushing spacing or get what we paid for. And we chose to get what we paid for, but that resulted in a delay in receiving the switchgear because the manufacturer was designing and was proceeding with constructor manufacturing of a switchgear that didn't have what we wanted. And just so you know what that purpose of that is, when the bushings are wider apart, and we specified 30 inches, previous bushings that we had on the top of the switchgear building were narrower, something closer to 8 or 12 inches. And wildlife will come fly by and get stuck in that, and it'll take the substation offline. So we believe that this wider spacing will alleviate that problem, and we thought it very important to go ahead and go forward with that. But the result was a switchgear building that arrived about 2.5 months later than expected. It arrived in the middle of November rather than September. And fortunately, we had really good weather, and we were able to get it down into the fairly steep access area of the villages. So that was a success. At least we didn't get snowed. So that did result in extra time with the project. And when you get extra time on a project, it's hard to avoid some extra costs that come along with that when you have workers out there working, our own district staff had already begun doing some of the traditional commissioning works. And on this project, we did something a little bit different than what we did on the previous substation. We worked with our crews, and we recognized where we had the issues on the previous substation. And one of the places that stood out were the power and control cabling for the substation. That's what operates all the devices, all the switches, everything like that, and comes from the control building. We got reviews from our crews during the design process, and they suggested that we put in an additional pole box where if something happened, if the switchgear building happened to come late, then we would at least have a place to terminate all those or store all those wires. We could pull them all in early. So our crews were actually on site working before the substation building arrived, which isn't typical. But due to the installation of this new pole box, we were able to do a bunch of work before the switchgear building showed up. So that was kind of one of the successes and something that we changed, and also a reason that our crews did a little bit more work than normal. Another item that was interesting was the bus work itself. We had the same contract with the Lance Fires using the Michael specific energy, and they are fairly well versed in building substations and have a lot of really talented crew when it comes to welding and installing the overhead bus work. Those are all the aluminum pipes that carry the power around the substation. And Michael's crews installing it thought that they saw where there might not necessarily be errors, but better ways of doing things. So we contacted ECI, our design consultant, and worked through some drawing changes. We accepted some of the changes. It was how you know, bent bars rather than weld bars, because they were a big enough contractor, they had that capability. So they made some design changes, and then we went further and had ECI come out to the site one day, go up in a bucket truck with our crews and inspect all the different things that we had going on there. They came up with one change relative to the expansion joint installation on this big bus work. And they felt it really should be changed, but our contractor was about ready to leave site. But we in-house have that capability to also work on these overhead buses. So we chose to do that work ourselves. So that did add some cost to it also. Our own crews retrofitting a design that came as a came during construction, something that our consultant thought would be a better design and something that we should do. So that's just like the power and control cable, and this is how our results have the ability to do some of this bus work.
which would be probably been up to the project. And because of all that, ECI and District 9 ran higher than our estimates. Our last budget revision that we did was August 2023. And when we were here to that budget revision, that was even before the switchgear building was definitely coming late. So we estimated the best we could at that time, not being able to foresee some of these changes I'm here talking about today. There's a couple other site items that added to it, and I thought they were worthwhile. Site access, for those of you that have been out to the substation site, it's down in a little bit of a valley. And we were able to get easements from two adjacent property owners to cross their property. And when we were looking and drawing up the easements, you're just looking at a flat piece of paper, but there's a lot of topography there. So we typically only like to get enough of an easement for what we need. We don't want to take too much property. But then there were some cut fills outside of our easement area, and that's considered construction, and the property owner knew about that. But once you get it constructed, you weren't able to see everything on the drawings. So some of the corners on the steep driveway going down to the neighbor's access, and they requested that we modify them a little bit so they feel safer. So we add a little bit of material, and we filled in a ditch or two with porous rock so it'll still drain, and just made a few different modifications. And the very last of that was we actually have installed 10 additional pine trees on both neighbors' properties, looking at the photos that we had beforehand, and actually seeing the site shape up with all the steel in the air and everything. We felt that we could do a little bit extra planting, and that just completed last week. And the final item was had to do with the irrigation. We designed and had a place within the orchard next door to tie in our irrigation, which is what we intended to do from the time we purchased the property to take care of the landscaping. And the adjacent property owner came up with a better way of doing it, actually going up through his property and tying into the main line. And he was looking forward to if someone after him that he sells the property to chooses to develop that area, he said, you may have houses or different kinds of construction there, and it may put your irrigation supply in jeopardy. So he offered to us to give us an easement to go up the edge of a little valley and up to the top irrigation tie-in and tie into that. And so we did that, so that added extra cost as well. So we do have several different things that added cost.
That's a change you will not regret.
Tying into the main line. So I was glad that the property owner actually brought that up. The adjacent property owner said, why don't you tie in up here instead? And I have a few lessons learned for this. I just wanted to cover it because it has been such an interesting project. One, we're working on the switch gear right now, the bid. We just had bid opening. We got the same apparent low bidder that we had on North Shore for the Bavarian substation. And we're talking about how to do a little bit more quality assurance through inspections with our own crews when we go down and do the site inspections before it comes up, and just really assure that the switchgear is ready to be shipped. We feel that this last one, everyone was rushed, and it wasn't ready, probably because of the redesign, but it wasn't quite ready to come up. So we caught a lot of things in the field, and our crews are pretty good about being thorough and making sure that everything's going to be right. So going forward, we're going to take what we learned on this last project and make sure we bring it with us when we do the field inspection on the next one. And then if we do catch items that need to be corrected, we want to correct those items down in the manufacturing other than on site. So that will help us out. We had really good luck with the power and control cabling change that we did, putting in the extra pole box. So we've incorporated that in the design of the next project. And our crews, they enjoy doing that work because they have to go back and check it all if a contractor does it. They have to put a wrench on everything the contractor did to make sure it was done correctly. So they say, as long as we're doing that, why don't we just do the work? So that was a small component. We thought that would be a good thing to do. And then just kind of finally as an overarching item, we really involved our crews in review of the design documents. We found a real value where they can tell us when we might do something better, have a better design. And we're also trying to have repeatable designs, even though each site looks a little bit different going forward. You'll notice that during the site selection work that we're doing.
Even though each site looks a little bit different, the components are the same, and our template is to try to build substations that have room to double the capacity in the future if needed, and can also accommodate our mobile substation. So. Any questions I could answer?
Yeah, well, not really a question, but kind of a comment. You know, as we are aware of the fact that our county is growing, the need for additional substations is growing, I'm just really pleased to hear that our crews are taking a more active role. And also the thought process, and I'm going to use the word innovation, that is being used out in the field as you look at the construction to streamline the process, to cut off any potential for problems where the equipment shows up and it doesn't fit spec. I'm very pleased to hear the discussions that you're having, the way that you're thinking this through, and the way that you're involving all parties, both our crews, which are turning more wrenches, as you mentioned, but also even our contractors who can come out and take a look at what we're doing and suggest a better way, such as bending a pipe rather than welding it. Really encouraged to hear what you have to tell us on the future construction of additional substations going forward, and the fact that the crews enjoy turning this wrench and having a lot of fun doing it. That's great. That's good. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Motion. I would move to increase the total project budget for Capital Project ES140005 North Shore Substation in the amount of $900,000 for a revised total project budget of $10,759,630 with no change to the overall 2024 distribution capital budget.
Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Did you raise your hand? No, oh, I'm sorry.
Aye.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. I just saw your hand and you thought, oh, you wanted to say something.
You, Gary.
All right.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Yes.
This will certainly help in the station. So I'm sure other stations, it's been a long time.
You have no further manager notes. Lisa's here for Kissing Trump.
Hello, we're almost halfway through the year. Unbelievable. Okay, so we're in June. I have Commissioners Arsenault and Bergman traveling to Nebraska this week. And Commissioners Arsenault, Smith, and Allen traveling to San Diego. I have packets on your desk. Then Commissioners Allen and Bergman traveling to Stehekin later this month, 19th and 20th. I have hotel rooms held for Wapuda meetings in Cowlitz County and Longview. I looked today, the registration isn't available on the website unless it is somewhere else that you've seen.
So what was the date on again?
Longview?
Yes.
17 through 19. I have rooms held the 16 to 19.
Yeah,
July. We have PNWER canceled with no fees for Allen. Mr. Arsenault traveling to Washington, D.C. in July for APPA policymakers.
PUDO meetings in September, water workshop in September, PUDO in October. Getting up there now.
We have, there's one more meeting that you have noted here, November 13 to 15, for WAPUDA. And I can tell you at this moment in time, I will not be attending that.
Any updates from anyone else? Miss anything?
Looks like you've got it, Lisa. Thank you. Okay, let's take care of special meetings coming up. I have a motion for our Mid-C meeting on June 18th.
I'll make a motion that on Tuesday, June 18, 2024, at 5:30 p.m. at Jack's at the Market, 1004 F Street Southwest Quincy, for the purpose of a Mid-C General Managers and Commissioners meeting.
Second. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Commissioners, anything else for the good of the order?
Just want a little bit of follow up on week ago Saturday. I did go up to Plain with Rachel. And that was, I was impressed with that event up there. It was all about safety. We were at the fire station. The PUD had a booth there to talk about our fire safety program. But the engagement, and that was on Memorial Day weekend, when it was a little bit cold and windy, but the engagement with the kids and the families brought, I mean, it was a real sense of community. I mean, it was impressive. And I just, you know, I don't know if we're doing others of that nature or not. But I mean, that's an opportune time, a great weekend, a lot of locals and a lot of visitors and a lot of kids. And the kids were having a ball and Rachel was ready. So it was time well spent.
Thanks. Follow up on delegation of action items from prior board meetings.
Yes, Commissioner, we had a couple of them. One was Chris Blaine provided an estimate of the number of full-time versus seasonal homes in the South Shore Relation Fiber Expansion Area. That info was provided on May 23rd. And then there was a follow-up on from the 517 Board Workshop, where Mark Mullins provided information on how much wood rates have increased to realize a 100 operating ratio and water waste from our fiber, the real cost of each system, add growth and expansion line to system liquidity graphs, show connections versus percentage growth for rate. And that was provided on May 23rd. And there was nothing to follow up on.
So at this time, I'll ask if there's any additional public comment. Seeing none, yes.
We just skipped over the delegated items for today.
Oh, My apologies.
We recorded one from today that had to do with Peyton Nelson providing information. Historical look at public power benefit funding criteria demonstrated a 10% allocation.
Okay, now there's no additional public comment. Are there any matters of general businesses may necessarily come before the commission today? Hearing none, we will be recessing and moving into executive session.
It can be about 45 minutes.
All right. Thank you very much.